You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Charles R. Allen, Jr., Virginia counsel for the appellant in this case. Also present is my co-counsel, who has been admitted pro hoc vice, John E. Gary III. I'm requesting permission from this court to allow Mr. Gary to make oral argument on the appeal. Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Gary, where are you practicing?
Charleston, South Carolina, Your Honor.
We're welcoming you here to Virginia.
Well, thank you very
glad
much.
To have you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is John Gary, and I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. Thank you for allowing me to participate. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, please.
All right.
For rebuttal. This case is about a release signed by an asbestos FELA plaintiff in an asbestosis case a number of years ago. The release purported to release all future claims for diseases of any kind, known or unknown, included a laundry list of diseases and issues, such as and including cancer. Mr. Cole later developed lung cancer, and he brought a second action under the FELA for his lung cancer case. I've argued this issue in other courts, and it's my biggest challenge to get the various judges and justices to fully embrace the extent of the FELA and what it means. What it means, first and foremost, is we have to put our knowledge of the black letter law of settlement and release to the side, because that is a state issue.
Can I ask you this? In your reply brief, you say that numerous courts apply Babbitt in, quote, nearly identical scenarios. I only counted two, which was the Sixth Circuit Babbitt case, and the Ohio case is within the Sixth Circuit applying Babbitt. It appears the Wicker test is far and away the majority rule. Am I reading the case law improperly?
No, I would agree with you there. There are a number of trial courts that have applied Babbitt, such as in Kentucky. I've actually argued it there on several occasions. But
published
I would agree with you.
Wicker is the majority rule interpreting FELA, and Babbitt is the minority rule applied by two courts.
Absolutely.
Well, then why isn't this a clear case under Wicker? Because you pled that there was an increased risk of cancer. The risk was obviously known at the time. The release and the settlement agreement specifically identified it as something that was acknowledged as a then-existing risk. It fits the FELA gloss on the black-letter rule as applied by Wicker, does it not?
If we were to follow Wicker exactly, you'd be correct.
Okay, why should
we? However, FELA, the validity of FELA releases are governed by, it is a federal question, it's governed by federal law. Part of our problem is we get into the federal law and we start to apply it, but we always fall back on our well-known precepts regarding state release law. So there are a number of ways to go about this, but the quickest and the best way is to go to the statutes themselves. We have to look at the statutes, and we have to understand what they say and the wording of the statutes so we know what we're dealing with and what law to apply to them.
May I interrupt you again? The
yes.
U.S. Supreme Court's interpreted the statute in 1948, and the language of the Cullen case is you can settle anything that is, quote, a controversy over a claimed liability. That's a very broad term. That doesn't sound like it's having any sort of pro-plaintiff or pro-defendant gloss on it. Why isn't Wicker, the majority rule in the federal courts, the proper interpretation of that?
Earlier today, you questioned, I believe it was the appellant in the intervention case about, don't you need a justiciable controversy to actually be able to participate in a lawsuit? And the answer to that question is absolutely yes, you do. In Gottschall, the United States Supreme Court explained to us that courts considering claims under the FLA required to look to the statute itself, to the FELA itself. We have to look at its purposes, we have to look at its background construction that the United States Supreme Court has given us. That's the Conrail versus Gottschall case. They also remind us that we need to liberally construe the FELA cases. Well, the first statute that we should look at is the FELA statute itself, 45 U.S.C. Section 51. Every common carrier by railroad shall be liable in damages to any person suffering injury while employed by such carrier, resulting in whole or in part from the negligence of, and I'll summarize, the railroad. The key issue is there must be an injury. We have to give meaning to the words of the statute. If there is not an injury, there is not a justiciable controversy that can be brought under the FELA.
But correct me if I'm wrong, no federal case since 1948 has held that you cannot settle an unaccrued liability claim.
Did you say unaccrued?
Right. You can't settle. Where's the federal law anywhere that says that? That it is not possible to settle a federal claim under FELA that is not accrued, other than Babbitt in an Ohio case.
That is not accrued.
Right. Because settlements typically include everything that arose from the underlying injury, whether the damage is accrued or not, which is, as you say, the black letter rule.
I think you're conflating the issue of accrual with the release of a known risk as discussed under Wicker. If a case is not accrued, you don't have legal authority to bring it. You have to have legal authority to come into court and ask for damages in order to get there in the first place. So
but
if
you
a
can
case
settle,
is not accrued,
you can settle a case
you
beyond
can't
what
bring
is,
it, much less settle.
Hold up. You can settle a case for damages that are not yet accrued when you brought the case for damages that have been accrued. In fact, as you point out, that's the way all settlements work outside of these curious contexts.
I would ask the court to look to a few Supreme Court cases that give us a little bit of instruction there. For example, in Uri v. Thompson, the Supreme Court made it clear that exposure is not an injury. They said that no specific date of contact with the substance can be charged with being the date of an injury. FELA claims do not accrue until a diagnosis occurs. Now, what Callan said was, if there is a controversy, you can certainly settle it, but there must be a controversy in order to use the release. You have to give meaning to the FELA statute itself that an injury is required, and that's what they're doing in the Uri v. Thompson case. In the Metro North v. Buckley case, the United States made, and that's the Snowman of New York cases where the workers were so covered with asbestos dust they looked white like snowmen. In the Metro North case, the Supreme Court said you cannot recover until manifest symptoms of disease occur. They were wanting to get emotional damages with no disease at all.
But the question is not, can the plaintiff recover for a meso claim when meso is not being diagnosed? The question is, can the defendant and the plaintiff by contract, when they know that the meso claim could later be presented and that there's a reasonable risk of it, settle it in the context of an asbestosis case? That's the issue.
That is the issue. That is exactly the issue. Arriving at the answer to that issue, you need to follow the federal statute and the federal law and not normal concepts or precepts regarding release and settlement.
Okay, let's accept that.
Okay.
And so let's move on.
In the Ayers case.
Excuse me. Let's move on.
Yes, sir.
Wicker is federal law. It interprets FELA.
It does.
If in fact, we adopt the risk of harm test from Wicker, why should your client prevail?
If I'm only allowed to address the case under Wicker, it's because the trial court did not fully apply Wicker. Wicker is not simply a soundbite that you can release future risk. Wicker had a number...
It's fact-intensive.
It's fact-intensive, and Wicker provided a number of guidelines. For example, Wicker's releases were not that much different from the release in the Cole case. But if you go to Wicker and you actually look, it says, in order for a release to be an effective release of a future known risk, it has to spell out the frequency and duration of the risk itself. Nowhere in the release Mr. Cole signed does it even attempt to do that. And in the release that Mr. Cole signed, you will see that there is a litany of diseases known and unknown, which includes every respiratory disease known to man, cancer, mesothelioma, asbestosis, etc. And it also lists a laundry list of toxic substances, silica, asbestos, etc., etc. All of these fall squarely within the Wicker prohibition against boilerplate language.
Weren't some of those also in Mr. Cole's complaint in the action that was settled?
The complaint in no way signifies Mr. Cole's intent to release his future claims for cancer. The allegations of the complaint...
I'm referring to whether he was aware of the exposure that he had been under. I'm looking at his knowledge. Was he aware that he had been exposed?
This is the error that I think the trial court made. The trial court went looking for facts that it thought it could import into its analysis of a release issue when the complaint was written. I am sure you understand that Mr. Cole didn't write the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you would understand that most...
I presume he read it. I presume his counsel spoke with him about it. I assume that the allegations therein were, in fact, his allegations, although expressed in lawyerly language.
I think that you would be in error, frankly, and I don't think most plaintiffs of this type have the ability to fully read and understand a legal document as important as a complaint.
He did not have the ability to read and understand that he was at heightened risk
for
cancer?
If you would look at the joint appendix...
You're down to 2 minutes, and you can use that time any way you'd like, yeah. But I'm just going to remind you that you wanted to save some time.
Yes, sir.
You can do it any way you want.
All right. If you look at the joint appendix in his deposition that's referred to in our brief, he clearly didn't understand the importance of what asbestos was or how it works. I don't think that you should be able to release a future claim for cancer if you don't completely understand what asbestos is and the effects it has on its body. His deposition is in this as part of the facts of the case. The court below made an error because they were looking for ways to find the release enforceable and valid. What they should have been doing is protecting the rights of Mr. Cole under the FELA, as the statute tells him.
As a general rule, you can't prove why a lower court is wrong until you've first proven that the lower court is wrong. So why was it wrong for a lower court to look at this complaint, which presumably should be, in fact, read by the party signing it, and see that it was a known risk. Hold up, there was a known risk of cancer. They pled it as a risk that would be associated with this lawsuit. And that squarely fits within the Wicker test, does it not?
I think it's outside of the Wicker test. I think the Wicker test properly focuses on the language of the release.
Yes,
and
but the language
release
of the release
itself
has to be a
void.
Known risk. So you go to the pleading and you say not only was it a known risk, it was a pled risk. Pled by the party who were asking did they know it or not. And as I understood your answer to the last question, well, our plaintiffs don't read these things.
Accepting your point to be true, the other evidence in the case is Mr. Cole's deposition testimony that they took in his first case. And the references in our brief to that testimony demonstrate clearly that while Mr. Cole was a wonderful man, he was not a sophisticated man who had a large understanding of these scientific and legal principles. So to focus on only one fact and find that that is dispositive of the question, I think, would be exactly what I was warning of earlier. You're looking for reasons to use state principles to find that the release is valid, rather than the FELA principle that the Supreme Court consistently tells us to do is to find a liberal interpretation and find a way that we can compensate the FELA employee. Now here, he had no idea that he was at a risk of cancer.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Gary, your time has expired. Mr. Freeman, you can obviously use your time any way you'd like, but somewhere in that time, I would like for you to assume, for the sake of argument, that the Wicker test applies, and then walk me through the facts that relate to this release and make your case.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman. James Jennings is with me at counsel's table. We represent Norfolk Southern Railway Company. Appellant's argument seeks to basically sidestep the critical overriding fact here, which is that Mr. Cole's first lawsuit did put the issue of Mr. Cole contracting cancer squarely in controversy. Mr. Cole specifically pleaded that his work around asbestos left him with an increased risk of contracting, quote, lung cancer and or other cancers, JA 39 to 40, paragraph 19. His own pleading confirms that Mr. Cole was aware of his increased risk of lung cancer.
Now, I understand from other cases that have been here that you can have asbestos-related lung cancer that is not mesothelial, and you can have lung cancer that's asbestos-related that is mesothelial. Factor that into it.
I think that there has been reliance by Mr. Cole as if the Ayers case says that because you can split actions that you have to. And it doesn't say that. In fact, it specifically says the opposite. At 538 U.S. 153, it said it was really important that those people in that case didn't plead increased risk of cancer. In fact, in the Wade case they rely on, same thing. The judge said it's really important they didn't plead increased risk of cancer. Increased risk of cancer, as Ayers says, is actually a cancer claim. You have a likely, if you can prove, and it's not just Ayers, Haggerty, Wilson versus Johns Manville, cited in our briefs, it gives you the opportunity to prove I've got cancer if you can prove it's more likely than not. That was in the pleading. It never got non-suited. It never got dropped. It was in the pleading. It was live at issue. And this is the critical thing, and I will talk about the boilerplate a little later. But it's not just boilerplate, as Justice Mims was, I think, getting to. This release specifically reflects twice their complaint. And he says, the release says, that we release all claims, the word all is in capitals, this is at JA 117, all claims and assertions set forth in his lawsuit are released. JA 117 says it again at JA 119. And this included his alleged increased risk of cancer and lung cancer, which is an active cancer claim. And that's a way to get more money at the time.
Let me bring it down to a bottom level. The Third Circuit test says the scope of the release is limited to those risks which are known to the parties at the time the release is signed. Assume, for the sake of argument, that it over the course of time we find out that tactile exposure to asbestos could in fact cause melanoma, skin cancer. But nobody knew that at the time. Is that something that is somehow covered by this release? The scope of the release is limited to those risks which are known to the parties at the time the release is signed.
Well, and it is a fact-intensive question. And if he were claiming skin cancer, I mean, clearly there are cancers listed and pulmonary respiratory illness caused by contact with asbestos specifically mentioned. All of those things are mentioned, and I would argue you'd have a strong case, but you'd have to look at the facts. But here, more than that was mentioned. What was mentioned is, I release everything in my claim, and he claimed lung cancer. Which
yeah,
is
you see,
what
the fact that it contains more is actually doesn't help you much under under the Third Circuit test. Because the problem, as he outlines it, is what you've got all this language, any and all, claims, debts, arising in any manner, and all other this and all other that. But the test in Wicker says that you don't waive it unless it is a risk that's known to the parties at the time the release is signed. And the argument is, and you know what the argument is the release is huge, well beyond what the risks that were known to the parties at the time, factually.
Okay, and I understand what you're saying, although you are asking me to sort of disregard that the release says, I release and forever discharge you for cancer, fear of cancer in any and all forms. But more importantly, it then says, I release you from my lung cancer claim. Which he brought, which is specifically what we're talking about. So I understand we could get out here on skin cancer, we could get out here on other claims. This is a lung cancer claim, and he specifically brought it, he specifically released it, and then the dismissal order, which is we asked for this, or we request entry of this order filed by his attorney, says all matters in controversy, have been compromised and settled, and the action is dismissed with prejudice. That's at JA 365. Okay, now FELA case law does make clear that parties can settle their claims without litigation so long as a legitimate controversy exists. Part of what makes a controversy exist is that it's pled and it's in issue. And that's Callan versus Pennsylvania Railroad Company, and in Callan's words, parties are free to compromise questions of whether there is liability and how much. And that's what happened here.
So maybe if I can shortcut this, I mm-hmm. can do that, but I want to get to the actual facts and run it through this analysis. At the time he signed the release, Cole did not have lung cancer.
He did not have lung cancer at that time. He had occupational pneumoconiosis.
Right.
And he pled that there's an increased risk, so he knew about it. Ayers says that there's a well-known associated risk. You'd have to be unwriting Ayers, actually, to say that he had no idea that he might have cancer. Ayers said you don't have to bring the claim now, although you can. So, bottom line, his pleading expressly put the issue in controversy. I have a bigger risk, and if I can prove that, I get more money. So, you know, under Callan, the release here should be deemed valid. And frankly, the trial court below, the circuit court below, found that Babbitt was passed as well as Wicker. And under Wicker, the appreciation of the risk of harm test says that a release is valid if it's executed for valid consideration as part of a settlement. This was clearly a settlement. The court looked at the consideration, clearly ruled it was adequate, did not shock the conscience, and in fact found that they didn't put on any evidence that it didn't pass muster. And by the way, this is a special plea, a plea in bar. And it's like the Hawthorne versus Van Marter case. They submitted everything to the trial court, and the trial court made its findings.
Will you do the same analysis under Wicker?
I am.
You want to do that?
This is Wicker, but you said we passed. I'll keep going, though. Valid consideration in settlement and the scope of the release is limited to those risks which are known to the parties at the time the release is signed. To say that he doesn't know of the risk is to say that he just disassociates himself from specifically what he pled and got more money for it. I mean, you're compromising both of the claims. So Wicker properly permits a release to cover an injury that has not necessarily accrued or been diagnosed, so long as, you know, it's in controversy, it's pled, it's out there. And that's totally consistent with Callan. That's exactly what Callan admits. Now, under the competing Sixth Circuit Bright Line or Babbitt test, which truly is a Sixth Circuit test that has been accepted by a couple of courts within the Sixth Circuit and rejected by several also, the judge also said that we prevailed. And that's because the issue was specifically raised as an increase in cancer claim, and it was settled. So
your opposing counsel points out that we shouldn't give dispositive weight to the pleading, to look at the deposition and other things, because you have someone who isn't legally sophisticated, et cetera, is relying on the attorney. So how do we, I mean, because under ordinary state law, that would be the end of it, but we're in federal land, it's different. So, and if it's fact-intensive, I don't think the pleading necessarily has preclusive weight. So how do we look at everything?
I understand, you know, this was submitted facts and law. It was submitted like Hawthorne versus Van Marter as a plea and bar, and the lower court made its ruling, and it made its ruling, and it's entitled to deference. Okay? The fact is that he found that the compensation was adequate for these claims. He found he pled, I believe he said it was beyond doubt that he was aware of it, because he saw that the pages were initialed. He saw that the Mr. Cole said he was aware of what the release said. And, you know, if you look at some of the meds, Mr. Cole at JA-368 was in the hospital or at the emergency room in 1984 worried about colon cancer. I mean, it's not just out of the blue. I've never heard. So it's a factual dispute.
Well, it could also be, I mean, the known risk of cancer was pled, and you can't take opposite positions in pleadings in related successive cases and basically blindside the other side with an absolutely inverse allegation.
Correct. And that brings me back to where the boilerplate. Because Mr. Cole suggests that under Wicker, boilerplate language is frowned upon and can invalidate a release. And that's not really accurate. Boilerplate is not determinative under Wicker. And releases are inclusive by their nature. And that's where your question, Chief Justice Simmons, comes into play. There's, again, here, we're at the best for the defense to be, because he pled lung cancer, and we're talking about lung cancer.
Yeah, and counsel, but let me, there earlier, either you misspoke, or I misheard, or I can't read. And I'm happy to put it on myself, but I thought you said that the release of pages 117 through 120 included a release of lung cancer.
No, sir. What it includes is a release of everything in his pleading at 117 and 119.
Okay.
And that includes lung cancer.
He pleaded lung
cancer. Because at JA 39 to 40, paragraph 19, he says specifically lung cancer.
Okay, very good. Thank you for clarifying that
process. No, I'm glad you asked. Thank you. So, getting back to the boilerplate, that matters more when you are in a situation where it's skin cancer, versus the same claim that you had before. And that's, you know, if you have a carpal tunnel release and then you come back with a hearing loss claim, then, you know, you better look at the boilerplate. Has the claim been swept away in boilerplate, or did they really know what they were doing? That is much less a concern here, where you have the exact same claim, lung cancer from asbestos contact, that you had in the first lawsuit. This is specifically what was pled before, and we think it clearly passes Wicker. The lower court said it passed Babbitt, too. I don't want to belabor the point, but
Talk about Babbitt, bookend this thing.
Sure. I will say two things about Babbitt. First, it is the inferior test, and if I have time, I will tell you why. But second, the court...
It is the less defense-friendly test.
No, it's not. It's not that, because we also won under it, and I think we should have, because the claim was live. It was in issue. This is what I think Justice Kelsey was getting at. A settlement of a live claim, no one has ever said that couldn't happen. And it was a live claim. He pled increased risk of cancer. It's out there. He did get more money for that. So, you know, you look at what Wade got when it was turned aside, $6,500. You look at what he got, $20,000. That's another thing the judge might have looked at. So we went under Babbitt, too. But Babbitt is a crummier test, and it's crummy because it really is at odds with Callan. Callan says that you're allowed to settle things if they're live. And Wicker recognizes that railroads and workers might knowingly and voluntarily want to settle their current and future claims. Mr. Cole is 78 years old. He might have wanted the money now. Wicker is more consistent with actual release practice, and Babbitt severely undercuts the favored policy of encouraging FDLA settlements. Mellon talks about that. It's favored under the FDLA. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Gary, I'm sorry, your time expired. The court will be adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.